Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Peter Hart. I'm with lovely Gary Bain. And today we're doing something close to your heart, so to speak, Gary. Something you've taken a lifelong interest in.
Pork pies.
Yes, pork pies. Who ate all the pies? Who ate all the pies?
We're doing a podcast on pork pies.
Yes. No. Eddie Rickenbacker. Who is he?
Well, he's the American ace of aces. And until the Second World War, he had the most victories of any of our American cousins.
Yeah. And why did we choose to Eddie Rickenbacker? What have we become aware of, Gary?
That people were getting sick of everything else we were doing.
That was part of it, yeah. And particularly we felt that we owed a bit of debt to our American cousins, who listened to us in surprising numbers, seeing as we keep doing accents they can't understand.
Yeah, so, and it's a while since we've done some. We did the Meurs-Argonne podcast. That's probably about 18 months ago now.
It is too long when we've got a lot of people out there listening to us and wondering what generic Northern means.
So this one, we thought we'd have a look at an individual.
Yep.
And frankly, Pete, a really, really interesting man who had he had more than one life. He had a number of lives.
He was reincarnated.
As we will discover. He wasn't just successful as a pilot. He was successful in a number of areas of his life.
I believe he's now a horsefly somewhere in India.
He probably is. Now, on that note, Edward Eddie Rickenbacker.
He was called Edward Eddie.
Well, I'm going to call him Eddie. He was known as Eddie in newspaper articles and the like, so I'm probably going to call him Rickenbacker, but I'm introducing him early.
You feel friendly, you feel close
to him. This is going to take a long time to get through, isn't it?
Right, sorry.
Now, he was America's most decorated scout pilot during the Great War and a Medal of Honor recipient with 26 victories. 26 victories.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
Well, when you consider the amount of time he was actually in the air, which will become apparent. But in a very full life, which I alluded to, he was also a pioneering racing car driver, an engineer, and a first-class mechanic. And in later life, he was the head of one of America's largest airlines, Eastern Airlines.
Never heard of him.
That's because they went bust.
Oh!
So, let's have a little bit about him, Pete.
Well, Edward Rickenbacker, as I call him, was born on the 8th of October 1890 in Columbus, Ohio. He's a third of eight born to German-speaking Swiss immigrants. Lizzie, I think her name might have been Elizabeth, but they are terribly informal out in the States, and Wilhelm Rickenbacker. Still such a fine old English name.
Well, that is actually spelt the German way. It's spelt B-A-C-H-E-R.
Oh, right, yeah. So he changes the spelling then.
Yeah, and much later he adopted a more American-sounding middle name, Vernon. Now, his parents instilled in young Eddie a strong work ethic and love for his country. He was also brought up in a very religious household.
Oh, was he? In 1893, they built a small home. They built it themselves on 1334 East Livingston Avenue. Quite a long road.
Or 1334.
Quite a long road, was it?
Yeah, obviously. Now, this was due largely because his mother invested in some land, much to the chagrin of Wilhelm.
Ooh.
Now, the house, it lacked running water, indoor plumbing, and electricity. And this is where he spent his childhood.
Now, as a small boy, he liked to take things apart. I used to do that, but and then try and find ways of reconfiguring them. His dad admonished him. It's like the words I remember from my father. He said, "Peter, you'll always be bloody useless."
Yeah, only this one was that a machine had to have a purpose.
That's more useful than being told you're bloody useless, isn't it? And he worked before and after school. He helped out at home. The family grew vegetables out back, I presume. Perhaps out front, I do not know. And cared for the livestock, I presume. He had some piglets and things. Do you know, Gary? No.
Now, he also earned money by delivering newspapers. He worked in a bowling alley and he sold anything he could scavenge.
What did he spend all his money on?
Well, he gave most of his earnings, like a good lad, to his mother. But he did spend some on tobacco as he'd smoked from the age of 5.
At what age did you start?
4. He probably had older
That's
sisters as well.
That's what stunted your growth, isn't it? How tall was Eddie Rickenbacker? Was he a dwarf as well?
Now, in what I would suggest is a recurring theme, Rickenbacker was accident prone as a child. At the age of 8, he had his first brush with death when he led a gang of friends down a slide in a steel cart into a deep gravel pit.
Just thinking how sensible that is. It overturned, didn't it? What happened?
Well, it cut his leg open to the bone. And on another occasion, his school caught fire and Rickenbacker ran back into the burning building to get his coat.
Many's the time we've said the words, "I'll get me coat," haven't we? In polite society.
Now, in later life, Rickenbacker came to believe that God had repeatedly saved him for a higher purpose.
Killing people?
Well, that was one of his purposes, yes.
So he became a religious lunatic, is what you're trying
to
say.
Well, no, he was brought up in a very religious household.
It's fair enough. Each to their own, as we say. He had something else that's close to your heart. What was that?
Well, he had an artistic bent, and he painted watercolours of animals, flowers and scenery.
He tried to design a perpetual motion machine, but his father told him he was wasting his time designing a machine with no purpose. I think his father just thought he was wasting his time because it was a waste of time. Was he a good schoolboy?
No, he played truant from school and he was the de facto leader of a gang called the Horsehead Gang.
Oh, I bet they got up to all sorts of mischief, Gaz.
Well, they did. And one occasion, once the Wright brothers had famously completed their first flight in the aeroplane, Rickenbacker tried to fly a bicycle fitted with an umbrella from the roof of a barn.
Did it work?
Oh, what do you think? Yes. Now, years later, his mother reflected on her son's childhood and how he had at times misbehaved. And this is Lizzie Rickenbacker.
In boyhood, no. In boyhood, now I've come to dinner. In boyhood, as in manhood, thought and action with Eddie were inseparable. I never saw its like. But his imagination, and he had a plenty, I'm sure it never soared to battles in the sky. Yes, he was a very, very mischievous boy, but never a bad boy.
Oh.
Neither his father nor I had the slightest turn for mechanics. There isn't a trace of it in the family, which came a generation ago to America from Switzerland.
As you can tell by the accent.
Yet he was only when busy with his hands making something. That you didn't stop the quote there, Gary. Making something that he stayed indoors and out of mischief. Right, that's the only accent we're doing.
Yes. Now, in August 1904, his father died after receiving a head injury when he was hit with a spirit level during a fight.
Yeah, he was in a coma. Wilhelm, Rickenbacker, in a coma for 6 weeks before he died. And the attacker, he was convicted of manslaughter and got 10 years in jail. How old was Eddie then? Carry 3. No, I can't work it out.
Just under 14 years old.
How do you know that?
Because I wrote it down.
Oh.
Now, although not the only potential breadwinner, Rickenbacker felt that he had to help replace the lost income on the death of his father, and he dropped out of school. Right. Bear in mind, he's just under 14.
He lies about his age and gets to get around the child labour laws to work full time. And during the next 2 years, he has 8 different jobs.
List them.
No.
At one of them, while working at Oscar Lear Automobile Company in 1905, he took a correspondence course in engineering. That's quite common in America, isn't it? Correspondence courses in
Yeah, so he'd be 15 then, would he? I'm trying to work, yeah.
In 1905, yeah.
Yeah.
But fate was about to change his life forever. And the next quote, it's taken from an article by somebody called Carol Vane Glees. And this was in the January 1999 issue of Aviation History. I've got them all in a big pile over in the corner.
And Carol was actually a chap.
Oh, that's good. And this is Carol Vane Glees. Engines became young Rickenbacker's passion, and he found a job that changed his life. In 1906, when he went to work for Lee Freyer, a race car driver and head of the Freyer Miller Automobile Company. Freyer liked the scrawny, scrappy lad and let him ride in major races as his mechanic. Rick later went to work as a salesman for the Columbus Buggy Company, which was then making Firestone Columbus automobiles.
Now, he follows this as a career, doesn't he? And by 18, so, you know, a couple of years later, he's a chief engineer at Firestone Columbus. And it's not his only role, is he? He's sort of a jack of all trades there, isn't
he? Yeah, he's a demonstrator, a salesman and a mechanic. Now, his employers, they're really pleased with him. And in 1910, at age just 19, he was sent by Firestone to manage the Upper Midwest Agency in Omaha, where he led a team of 6 men and was responsible for sales, distribution and maintenance of Firestone Columbus cars in 4 states. And have a guess how much he was paid.
About $10 a week.
Listen to this, $150 per week. Now, roughly, allowing for inflation and carrying the noughts and whatever, $4,600 in today's money.
That sounds a lot.
So 19.
And trying to work it into pounds for our English listeners.
It's about the same nowadays.
It's about the same, or less.
Now, Rickenbacker decided that he would enter a 25-mile race held in Red Oak, Iowa, as a way of drawing attention to the company's car.
Ooh, does it go well? Does he draw attention to the company's car?
Well, it's his first automobile race, and he failed to finish, having crashed through an outer fence. So he did draw attention of sorts.
Yeah. Now, through that, that started something, doesn't it? And it becomes part of his life. He enters and wins a number of dirt track races, including 5 of the 6 races at the Aksarban Festival in October. Where is Aksarban, mate?
It's just outside Wimshaven. Now, the newspapers reporting on these races, they misspelled his name in a variety of ways, calling him anything from Rickenbau, Rickenbacher, or Reichenberger, before they finally settled on Rickenbacker, spelt B-A-C-K-E-R.
Mm. Now, in May of the following year, Lee Freyer invited Rickenbacker to join him as his relief driver in the first ever Indianapolis 500. Now, that's a big thing. That's the big thing now. I presume it was that's starting.
What a relief.
Yeah, what a relief. so he doesn't just sit in the co-driver's seat, does he?
No, he drove the majority of the laps, and he actually helps Freyer to 13th place. He also completed the following year, but he was forced to retire after 100 miles.
Yeah, they're long races. Yeah, is it 500 miles?
Well,
I don't know,
but I would walk 500 miles.
Yeah.
Anyway, Rickenbacker decided to quit his job and he went on the county fair circuit.
Now, problems then arose because in October 1912, the American Automobile Association, they cracked down on drivers and organisations that flout safety regulations. And I would imagine Rickenbacker was one of them. So what happens?
Rickenbacker's banned for the following 12 months. And so he joined the workshop of Frederick and August Duesenberg in Iowa, where he worked up to 16 hours a day.
I think it's pronounced August.
At $3 a day.
That's less than 150.
That's a lot less than 150, isn't it?
Now, next year, July 1913, Rickenbacker's given permission to compete for the Duesenberg team in his hometown race. And somehow he manages to keep on racing throughout that year. He's quite difficult to pin down in these races, isn't he?
Yeah, he won three times, though, during the season. And in 1914, the team parted company with its main investor. And so winning prize money for the team became the primary goal, because without prize money, he wouldn't be able to race what was left of that season.
So he won the 4th of July race at Sioux City, and another driver finished third. Another one of his drivers, if you like, of their team drivers. And that brings a combined prize of 12,500. And that left the Rickenbacker, the team, finishing able to finish the season. And does he do well overall?
Yeah, he finishes 6th in the rankings of the AAA, that's the American Automobile Association. Now, following a brief period with the Peugeot and Maxwell teams, which he called the worst mistake of his racing career.
Why?
Well, it's perfectly obvious to anybody who can think about such things.
You mean of the meanest intelligence?
I wasn't going to say that because I've
forgotten. Do you mean me?
Well, basically, when he moved to Maxwell, he stopped being successful in any way.
Or was
shape
it
or
Peugeot
form.
He stopped being?
No, it was Maxwell. Right. He did okay at Peugeot, but right. Maxwell, he didn't do well at all. And Rickenbacker then continues to have success.
Now, this is a point. Funny enough, in my head, I was drifting to thinking, oh, the war's started. But it hasn't, of course, has it? It's not started for another 3 years.
Well, not for the Americans.
Not for the Americans.
But it has for Europe. You're quite right. There is a war in Europe. And in 1915, he joined the new Presto Light team.
New Presto Light.
And in that season, he won at Sioux City for the third year in a row.
So what's his overall position in racing? I mean, is he really just another racing driver, or is he something more?
I think you're referring to his profile, aren't you? Yeah. And he was now one of the most famous racing drivers in America. And he earned an astonishing $40,000 a year. Now, during this period, he wrote a little book of rules and regulations for the team, which contained advice that he basically lives by for the rest of his life. And this is what Eddie Rickenbacker wrote.
If you don't like the way we do business, if you don't like your teammates, don't grouse and don't come around with a long face. Quit this job and get another one somewhere else. The trouble with a lot of people is that they are not willing to begin anywhere in order to get a fighting chance. My advice is, throw away false pride. No honest work is beneath you. Jump in and demonstrate your superiority, which is what you did at TFL in many ways.
But also, you think about it, he's gone from a $150 a week job and you know, he's not too proud to earn $3 a day.
No, so he lived by that. He really did.
Now, it was at this point that Rickenbacker signed for the British Sunbeam team for the upcoming season, and he set sail for England.
England at war.
England at war.
Did he have any problems when he got to... He landed at Liverpool, didn't he?
He did. And when he landed, he was detained by two plainclothes officers and he was prevented from leaving the ship.
Now, Why? I think I can guess why.
Well, there is a suggestion that an article in 1914 claiming that the racer was Baron Rickenbacker, the disowned son of a Prussian noble, led to the British authorities thinking that he was a German spy. But Rickenbacker himself later said,
I went to England to purchase a Sunbeam. I secured passports and on arrival in Liverpool was questioned by the authorities there, the British Intelligence Bureau. I was ordered to stay on the boat that was going to be returned, so he's going straight back to America. They were looking for a German spy whose description I answered to a T. And with the name of Rickenbacker attached to me, of course they thought they had him. He sailed at the time I sailed. So from America, I presume. Yeah, wow.
Now, fortunately, he's able to use the same ingenuity that would later help him to save lives to get him out of a tricky situation. And he goes on to say,
Christmas Day came along and I persuaded the authorities to let me spend Christmas Day on land. I was able to get in touch with Mr. Coatland, who was the directing manager of the Sunbeam Works, and he vouched for my status and he got in touch with the Intelligence Bureau, and they allowed me to proceed to London. I was able to get in touch with the English officers, and from their attitude and morale, I realised that America would have to get into the war sooner or later.
Now, he spent the week working at the Sunbeam Works in Wolverhampton, and then the weekends in London at the Savoy Hotel. Now, that's quite a contrast.
Well, Are you saying that Wolverhampton's different from the Savoy?
Just a bit. Now, he remained in England for 6 weeks, during which time he was under full-time surveillance by the British authorities before he returned to America.
So he hadn't really gone to... He'd sort of gone to get this new car and work on things, and right. He wasn't racing in England.
No. I think the idea was to use their car. Now, while he was in England, he'd actually watched the Royal Flying Corps aircraft flying from the Brooklands Aerodrome, which was also a famous car racing track. And he began to think about a role in aviation should America enter the war.
So he has two meetings, doesn't he, with British aviators, or who are they?
Well, he has two chance encounters with aviators. Glenn Martin, who gave Rickenbacker his first flight, and Major Townsend Dodd, who would later become General Pershing's aviation officer, so not British.
Hmm. So now Rickenbacker's confident that the racing fraternity in America had something to offer. And following the declaration of war on Germany by the United States, that's April 1917, he went to Washington, D.C. What does D.C. stand for?
Washington.
To propose his idea. And he says this: I felt that the boys in the racing game were better qualified for aviation than any other type of men we had. I also knew that the mechanics who had been interested in this sport and had experience with their high-speed motors and their development that aviation had not come to yet, so I thought it would be a good plan if I could organise the racers who'd been racing on land as pilots and the mechanics as enlisted personnel and have the government supply the necessary physical personnel to bring about this organisation. And there was no appropriation allotted for any part, for such a project. And I was also discouraged to the extent that they said that the more a man knew about motors, the worse off he was as far as aviation was concerned, because he would pay too much attention to the motor and not enough to the flying and fighting. Wow. And on that note, while we think about that, let's think about it, Gary. We'll have a short break.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
By June 1917, Rickenbacker was in France, where he enlisted in the US infantry, and he was assigned a role as a driver for General Pershing's staff.
Woo! Wanted a fast driver, did he?
Well, at this point, Rickenbacker earned the rank of Sergeant First Class, but he never drove for General Pershing, and he spent most of his time as a driver for Major Dodd.
Hang on. That name is familiar to me.
It's the man he met earlier, and he was now General Pershing's aviation officer.
Major Townsend Dodd, yeah.
Now, during this time, a chance encounter with a Captain James Miller led to him becoming the chief engineer at the flight school and aerodrome that was being established by Captain Miller at Usedom. Now, Rickenbacker thought it would he would be a shoo-in for the aviation corps.
Yeah, he did. He says this. A long practice in driving a racing car at 100 miles an hour or so gives first-class training in control and judging distances at high speed and helps tremendously in getting motor sense, which is rather the feel of your engine rather than the sound of it, a thing which you get through your bones and nerves rather than simply your ears. Well, he's not quite right here because,
Well, he was mistaken because most of those recruited to train as pilots, they had college degrees.
Yeah, I'm not entirely certain about that, but it certainly that was part of it, wasn't it? And they did go through courses that meant that.
Let's remember, he dropped out of school at the age of 14 on the death of his father. But what he lacked in education, he more than made up for in drive and determination.
Yeah, because he's an engineer, he's got bags of access to aircraft and he practices flying, presumably at first with somebody else as a co-pilot, you know, but he does, you know. But there's a complication. What always happens if you're a good subordinate or a good mechanic?
Well, his superiors considered him to be more valuable as a mechanic than they did as a pilot, and they continued to keep him grounded. But in order to get around that, Rickenbacker began to train someone else to replace him as chief engineer. And in November 1917, the Burlington, which is Iowa, Gazette reported this.
Where's Iowa?
America. They can't make them too fast for Eddie Rickenbacker, American speed demon now in France with General Pershing's forces. Rick went as an automobile driver and for a time was attached to Pershing's personal staff as his driver. But this was too slow for the speed merchant and he asked to be transferred to the aviation corps where he could get some real speed. The transfer was made and Eddie entered an aviation training camp in the south of France. It took him 6 weeks to complete the course, which usually occupies 4 months of training and instruction. And Eddie is now a regular airman.
Yeah, and Rickenbacker describes that course himself because he's put on, he's got a replacement and he's sent on the course. And he says this, I had about 4 or 5 hours with an instructor and then took my first solo hop. That's very quick, Gary. And then Rickenbacker didn't say that's very quick, Gary. He didn't know you. And then I averaged 3 or 4 hours a day flying alone. Took my spiral test, took my cross-country tests and had completed all my tests at the end of 18 hours. Wow. But the rules required a man to be up 25 hours in the air before he was qualified to receive his brevet. And during that 25 hours, he was supposed to make 50 landings. Well, I still had 7 hours to fly, and I also had about 22 landings to make. So I started out one morning to visit the surrounding aerodromes. I had an order on any of the French aerodromes to supply me gasoline if I landed at them. I put in the 7 hours that day, and the following day I did my landings, one after the other. That is, I would go up and circle round and land and go up again and come back and land without stopping the motor. Presumably he'd have landed at the French aerodrome, so I'm not sure why he did that as well, but never mind. Perhaps he had to do it witnessed by the people.
Now, Rickenbacker was assigned to the 94th Aero Squadron, which was known as the Hat in the Ring Squadron. Now, later, Rickenbacker explained the nickname in an article for the American public in August 1918. And this is now Lieutenant Eddie Rickenbacker of the 94th Aero Squadron.
I'm a lieutenant. Every man has a picture of a hat in a ring on his machine. That means he's ready to fight at any time, whether he wants to or not. The squadron is sometimes known as the Hat in the Ring Squadron, but amongst ourselves, it's the Gimpers. I'm not sure that means the same in English as American. We adopted the Hat in the Ring as our emblem back in our training days. Then it was our hope to be the first fighting squadron to get to the front. Our commanding officer, who'd been with the French, used to have a hat as the emblem on his machine. Someone suggested that we take the hat, put a ring round it, carrying out the idea of ex-President Roosevelt's famous statement that we were ready to fight any time. Doug Campbell added the finishing touch to the hat in the ring emblem when he got his fifth hun, and he became the first of all, first all-American trained ace. That's, yeah. Somewhere he scarred up, scared up a paintbrush and painted a little black cross in the ring around the hat for each German he brought down. They were regular German crosses, just like the one you see on German planes before you let them have it.
Wow. So said in a very matter-of-fact way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, Rickenbacker's first sortie on the 13th of April 1918 nearly ended in disaster.
Ooh.
Remember I said he was a bit accident-prone?
Yeah. Why? What
Both happened? He and a colleague got lost in fog and were forced to land. Flight Commander David Peterson called Rickenbacker a bloody fool for flying off in fog.
Oh, now, but that, you know, 16 days later, 29th of April, Rickenbacker shoots down his first German aircraft. And that it's described in the Chicago Tribune some 20 years later. Now, go on, tell me.
It was late in the afternoon of April 29th, 1918. Above was the deepening blue of the sky. Below was the shell-torn earth, and 100 feet away at Eddie's left wingtip roared his patrol mate, Captain James Norman Hall, in a similar Newport. Suddenly, Hall's plane banked and began to climb and spiral upward to the left. Rickenbacker followed. He didn't know what was up, but he had faith in Jimmy Hall. A speedy German Albatross scout plane was approaching from the north.
Now, that's very much a journalist's article, and it's interesting how journalists then as now get a lot of things wrong. And according to Rickenbacker himself, it was a false scout, and it would be his first kill. And he says this: I clung as closely to Hall as I could. With his first dive, I was right by his side. We had at least 1,000 feet advantage over the German, and we were 2-1 numerically. He's good at maths, isn't he? At 150 yards, I pressed my triggers. That's long range, by the way. The tracer bullets cut a streak of living fire into the rear of the Falz's tail. Raising the nose of my airplane slightly, I lifted the fiery streak like a stream of water from a garden hose. Gradually, it settled into the pilot's seat. The swerving of the Albatross's course indicated that its rudder was no longer held by a directing hand. At 2,000 feet above the enemy's lines, I pulled up my headlong dive and watched as the enemy circled a little to the south and the next minute crashed into the ground. Wow, that's a quite descriptive account. Also slightly purple prose, so an after-the-war account, possibly.
Yeah, possibly. Now, Norman Hall, who he fought alongside that day, survived the war, and he later went on to write Mutiny on the Bounty.
Oh,
which is just a complete aside and meaningless and adds nothing to the podcast.
Oh, I think it's a crucial
but
detail.
But I thought I'd add it anyway.
Well, he also wrote an autobiography, which is colourful.
Yes.
Those of you who are my American friends, I'm not criticising Hall. It's just he wrote it to make money, and I don't blame him for that.
Now, Rickenbacker received his first Distinguished Service Cross for extraordinary heroism in an action near Montsec, France, on the 29th of April, 1918.
Well, that sounds like it's the action we've just heard about.
And, yeah, and a second soon follows.
Sounds a bit soft. That's not extraordinary heroism.
And a second follows for extraordinary heroism in action over Richecourt, France, on the 17th of May, 1918.
So he's doing well. I mean, these orders do seem a little bit much at times, but it's the culture of the time.
They're looking for a hero.
And we're certainly not
the first American trained scout pilots.
And we're certainly not saying that they weren't heroes, because I think we're both admirers of Rickenbacker.
By the 28th of May, he claimed his fifth kill and become an ace.
Wow,
I always think that's very low numbers to become.
Oh no, it's from early. It's what it was early in the war.
And later that same month, he received the French Croix de Guerre, as well as yet another Distinguished Service Cross.
Yeah, he'll have no room in his uniform if you don't watch it with the DSOs. DSCs, sorry, that's an English mistake. Now, 30th of May, 1918, he achieves his sixth victory and the fifth Distinguished Flying Cross. They came up with the rations, I suspect. And the action was described by a fellow ace, and this is Major James Meissner of the 94th Aero Squadron, so Hat in the Ring Squadron. And what does he say, Gary?
I was in combat with a German and just dived down to attack the German plane. And in diving down to make the attack, the entering edge of my plane tore away again. Then, as I straightened out to return home, being in that condition, the German saw my predicament and he came back. I could not manoeuvre fast. The German was coming closer and closer, and he was shooting all the time. And then Rickenbacker came up alongside. Rickenbacker got him. Rickenbacker was a little ahead, and he came down as fast as he could and assisted. That time I flew back to the field and landed all right.
Now, this is the interesting thing about how long he's thinking. He started in April, mid-April. 29th was that his first kill? I can't remember. This is not long, but that's the end of it for a while. It's the end of May, and what happens?
Well, it's his last victory for more than 3 months.
Why, Gary? Why?
Well, in June, he had a fever and an ear infection that developed into an abscess. And whilst recovering in hospital in Paris, he was reflecting on his shortcomings as a pilot. And he decided that he needed to be less impetuous and have more self-discipline. That's quite extraordinary,
why,
really.
Why have you never reflected on your shortcomings?
Because I've never had an abscess.
Yeah. Why have you ever had more self-discipline? But he gets out of hospital in time for the St. Mihiel offensive. And he, by this time, the squadron are based in Rembecourt Aerodrome. And the offensive takes place on the 12th of September 1918. It's the first major, mainly American offensive. They're backed up by French artillery and things. But it's a big thing. The Germans have actually evacuated the salient, but it's still a big thing. It is a very big thing.
And for these actions, he receives his 6th DSC on the 14th of September. On the 12th of September, and on the 14th of September, his 7th.
Yeah, right.
I may have got that wrong, actually. I think he got his 6th on the 14th, and he got his 7th the following day. Now, by this time, he's promoted to captain. And he's given command of the 93rd Squadron.
Oh, not a major then. Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
Who, along with other squadrons of the 1st Pursuit Group, had converted from Nieuport planes to the more durable and higher-powered SPAD 13s, which was an excellent aircraft, which was suited to Rickenbacker's style of attack.
Well, they're both excellent aircraft. Newports are good. And the SPAD is 13 is a good aircraft, isn't it, you know?
Now, he gets to work to turn the underperforming 94th Squadron back into a team, reminding the mechanics...
Have they drifted a bit while he's away?
Yeah, I mean, they're still performing, but he didn't think that they were acting as a team. And he reminds the mechanics, for example, that he was one of them and stressed how important their work was for the success of the squadron.
Yeah, the other thing is, and this is classic leadership, isn't it? And I admire it enormously in Rickenbacker. He told his squadron that he wouldn't ask them to do anything he wouldn't do himself, either first as to set an example or alongside them. I think that's great. And are there any examples of that?
Yeah, on the 25th of September, to sort of underscore the point, Rickenbacker takes a solo patrol over the line, And he shoots down 2 enemy planes the next morning. Now, his victories that day earned him the Medal of Honour that we referenced earlier, although that wasn't awarded until 1931. So I presume by that it was converted from a DSC to a Medal of Honour.
I've no idea, yeah.
It was.
No, I see. You know about these things.
Now, Rickenbacker shot down another Fokker.
Oh, no, that's the D-7.
Yeah, and I was going to stop at another Fokker.
I know why, but I remember American friends don't like us saying Fokker.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah.
But the D-7s, this isn't preying on an old-fashioned aircraft. This isn't the Fokker from the earlier days of war. Fokker D-7, probably the best aircraft in the war. There just weren't many of them. But it's a real opponent, isn't it, the D-7?
Yeah, and you said Fokker a number of times there.
I did not say Fokker a number of times.
You did. He shoots it down on the 27th of September, and he then spent a month targeting the heavily defended enemy observation balloons.
Well, that's crucial. Why is that important, Gary?
Well, because it's... constant view, and
so they don't have to land.
They don't have to land. They can stay up there unless you shoot them down. Now, he held regular briefings with the men of the 94th Squadron, detailing methods for the attack and ideas for battle tactics, all of which were laid out on blackboards, which is a bit like a modern day football.
And I think they mean American football, because I'm particularly thinking of the way they do it. What's the problem in attacking the balloons? I mean, we talked about this in the last one. Do the Germans just fly the balloon, or do they have defences around them?
No, they have defences, and very serious defences as well. So you're going to be... they're not easy.
No. Lots of machine guns, anti-aircraft guns. It's just a nightmare.
And not easy.
And not easy. That's absolutely right. So how's he going by the end of October?
Well, he'd shot down 13 Fokker D7s. 13. And that's, four that's other types of German aircraft.
I think that's impressive.
As well as five observation balloons and four reconnaissance planes. And this brings his total to 26 victories, 15 of which were in the last 6 weeks of the war. 15 in the last 6 weeks.
Yeah, that's quite impressive. Now, in total, why do we know his name more than any other American pilot at the time? Although I can think of other pilots at the time.
He flew more patrols and spent more hours in the air than any other American pilot in the service, a total of 300 combat hours. It wasn't just Rickenbacker. By the end of the war, the 94th had the highest number of victories of any American squadron.
And I think that's to Rickenbacker's credit in many ways. It's like the effect, to use a British hero to show what we mean, Manak, the impact Manak had when he joined a squadron, it would immediately become more efficient and a better killing machine, leading from the front, teaching this business of, it's what we said about
transferable skills. And
it's what we said about the great aces. They not only could do it themselves, but they could inculcate the tactics into other people. Yeah, that's fabulous.
Mick, really, and Eddie. Mick and Eddie.
Mick and Major Edward Manick.
Yeah. Now, this is all a bit romantic, yes. and possibly not actually the case, but on the 11th of November 1918, Captain Rickenbacker flew a solo flight above No Man's Land at 11 o'clock to observe the armistice as the fighting stopped. And this is what he said.
Yeah. I was the only audience for the greatest show ever presented. On both sides of No Man's Land, the trenches erupted. Brown uniformed men poured out of the American trenches. Grey-green uniforms out of the German. From my observer's seat overhead, I watched them throw their helmets in the air, discard their guns, wave their hands. Now, you see, that I find, I don't believe a word of that. It's not what happened. In fact, an American chap whose name was Gunter was killed 2 minutes after the armistice. If you ran out of the trenches on the stroke of 11 o'clock, the other side would have shot you. So I think this is more later in the day sort of thing.
As I say, it's very romanticised and unlikely to be accurate.
But it gives an idea of the emotions of the time, perhaps, and how people felt and how Rickenbacker felt.
Now, he left the Army Air Service in 1919 with the rank of captain. He developed a taste for fame. And that's not only from, you know, the service, but you know, he was a racing car driver. And it wasn't difficult for the Army to convince him to remain in service. So he spent the first months back home in America, touring the country, encouraging people to continue to buy Liberty bonds.
Now, what sort of performance would he put on?
Well, he was an excellent speaker, although he appreciated what it was the Army wanted of him, and he wasn't averse to speaking a bit of bollocks from time to time.
Are we going to have an example of that?
Yes, and you're going to give it to us. And this is Captain
what
Eddie
Rickenbacker. What better person to give some bollocks? Before going up, I had pasted a poster on my machine which read, "Buy bonds or fight." While observing the enemy planes, which were getting close to me, I looked over the side of my plane and my eye caught sight of the Goddess of Liberty and the impressive injunction, "Buy bonds or fight." I knew I couldn't buy bonds just then, so I quickly decided to fight. In the struggle for air superiority that followed, two of the Kaiser's men were put out of business forever, and the third was forced to land behind his own lines. That was my first dazed fight, and the Liberty poster supplied the inspiration for me to go and get the Huns. Absolute bollocks from start to finish.
But may have persuaded some
people. And appallingly read, I'd just like to say, because it made no sense as I read it.
And may have persuaded some people to buy Liberty bonds. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, no, that's... Yeah, and he's doing a good job for his country. That's what he was required to do. As he said, Rickenbacker knew what they wanted.
Mm. And now, by way of thanks, he was promoted to major for the efforts before he was finally discharged. But Rickenbacker felt that this wasn't a rank that he'd earned, and so he always referred to himself as captain for the rest of his life.
It's so different from some people. Those people who get promoted at the end and then use that for the rest of their life. I think that
That's why I'm called Brigadier Bane, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, because you had three colonels working in your department.
Now, he spent the time immediately following the war writing Fighting the Flying Circus, which was his own exciting account of the battles fought by the American pilots in the air war over France. And it is one of the primary sources for this podcast.
He got a lot of money from that, didn't he? He used the proceeds and his severance pay, which I doubt was much at all, to start the, what was it called?
We started the Rickenbacker Motor Company. Now, Eddie Rickenbacker received the Distinguished Service Cross a record 8 times, one of which was upgraded to the Medal of Honour he received in 1930, as well as the Legion of Honour and Croix de Guerre from France. I think that's 1931, actually, he got the medal.
You caught me there. I was just about to correct you. I was just looking through to try and find it.
I think he's 31. Now, his 26 victories remained the highest number recorded by an American ace until Richard Bong recorded 40 victories during World War II.
Well, that's enough excitement for any man, and I'm sure that that was the last we'll ever hear of Eddie Rickenbacker.
No, because at some point, if we ever get round to it, there's going to be another podcast detailing more excitement of Captain Eddie Rickenbacker's amazing life, which continues to tell the story of this brave man and his incredible life.
I think he's a true hero. I'd be interested if there's any alternative viewpoints. He seems to be. I've not seen anything negative about it, but you've particularly studied this for the. Tell us which books you found most useful.
Well, largely his own book, Fighting the Flying Circus, which he wrote in 1919, but also his book Rickenbacker, which was
who wrote that?
It was by Edward V. Remember Vernon? Edward V. Rickenbacker.
He liked to be called Vern.
Which was published by Prentice Hall in 1967. But also Eddie Rickenbacker, The Life and Legacy of America's Top World War I Fighting Ace, which is one of the Charles River Editor's books, which is a much, 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 much abridged version of his life. No, but it's useful. I sometimes like to read what we describe as noddy books.
Yeah, get you in the mood.
Because it gets you in the mood and gets you sort of behind the story. Now, that's that for today. I would just like to say for our American friends that our book, Laugh or Cry, will apparently be available in America
in January, I'm not sure when this podcast will be out, but it'd be good to look for it on American Amazon or any other American bookshops.
And we do appreciate the support that we get from our American friends, and but buying a book is a surefire way of supporting a book. Podcast.
Well, it's better than buying us a coffee or a bit of that.
And it means that we
thing.
Can continue to produce this drivel.
Yeah, we'll be doing more American stuff this year. We're looking forward to it. And it's our New Year's resolution for 2023, isn't it? Be better and do more American stuff.
They're not my resolutions.
Or yours. And on that note.
Cheers, Pete.
Cheers. Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?